sometimes with her. Whatever, but hope that you will feel, like all of us feel, that this is really the home of the Jewish people. This is a place to connect to God, to your history, to your people, to your nation. And again, I do want to compliment you the fact that you decided to come here for whatever number of weeks you're going to be here. I mean, you already have that sense of being a member of the Jewish people. And, you know, sometimes people say, oh, the Jew, the chosen people, isn't that racist? Isn't that exclusive? Isn't that looking down at other people? And let me just make an obvious point. There's nothing novel that I'm talking about. The concept of chosenness has never meant superiority. It really is responsibility. And indeed, the Jewish ethic is predicated, in fact, the phrase, Judeo-Christian ethic, which, you know, I'll take as a phrase, is based on Torah, which says in Genesis that all human beings, not only Jews, there were no Jews when Adam was created, all human beings are in the image of God. And God, of course, does not have an image. God does not have a physical image. So the phrase, the image of God, however you exactly translate the Hebrew, does not connote any visualization aspect, but it connotes moral and spiritual qualities, autonomy, free choice, free will, wisdom, understanding. And you look at everything you see in that particular way. And therefore, chosenness is really much more of a responsibility ethic than it is a privileged ethic. So in a sense, it's perfectly good to be proud of being a Jew and recognizing that, you know, perhaps the book on great Jewish heroes of the NBA might be a little short, although, you know, even there we have but in many other areas, you know, there's a lot to be proud of, and the pride should not be arrogant, and it should not be looking down at anybody, God forbid, but it should be a sense of proud where you are. And you come from a very, very glorious heritage, and this is an opportunity for you to explore a little bit of what that heritage is, what it means to be Jewish, and hopefully wherever you go back to, you will take some of that pride and some of that knowledge with you. You know, let me tell you a little bit of a joke. You know, the phrase in Judaism for a person that's a heretic or a non-believer is called apikoris. I don't know if you've heard the phrase or not. It's from the Talmud. But in Europe, wanted to become an apikoris. He was in an Orthodox environment, and he decided, I want to reject everything. So he was told, this was in Minsk, city in Russia, famous city in Russia. So he said, well, if you want to be an apikoris, you have to meet with Yasula. Yasula is the town apikoris. So the guy is looking for Yasula. The free thinker is looking for Yasula. Where do you think you'll find apikoris? Maybe a bar, maybe a lounge, maybe a salon. And he's looking in all of those places, and he can't find Yasula. Finally, he is directed to the Beit HaMidrash, the study hall. And he's looking around for someone who looks like an apikoris, but the only person there is a man with a long white beard, with tefillin on his head and a talis over his head, and he's sitting in front of a big volume of Talmud. So he goes over to him and says, I'm looking for Yasula the heretic. He says, that's me. He says, well, you don't look like a heretic so much. You look like a Yasula the heretic looks up and says, well, what can I do for you? He says, well, I want to be a heretic. I want to join your club. So Yasula says, have you mastered the Talmud? He says, well, no, I don't believe in it. Do you know the Torah? He says, no, I don't believe in it. He says, you're no heretic, you're just ignorant. And the message of that lesson is that ultimately the decision to serve God, the decision to keep the commandments, is a matter of free will. No one's going to put a gun to your head. No one's going to starve you. No one's going to deprive you of sleep. Oh, well, maybe that will get a little bit here. And the like. So, you know, our goal here as educators, yeshiva, is not to brainwash you. But simply to expose you. Meaning to say that when you make a decision, whatever your decision is, the decision should be a matter of knowledge. You need to know what you're rejecting. We hope you're not going to reject it. We hope you'll embrace it. But whatever your decision is, it shouldn't be because you didn't know. So our goal really is to empower you by giving you, of course, I'm not going to say we're going to give you all the knowledge because that's not possible. You could be here 1,000 years, 1,000,000 years. You know, none of us have even skimmed the surface. But to give you a certain knowledge base, a certain sense of both experiential knowledge, or these things, and cognitive knowledge, learning information. And then you make your decision. Now, your life is your own. God has given human beings free will. You will make your decision. But the only claim we make to you, the only request we make of you, is that you be open-minded, that you be humble, because all of us have to be humble, recognizing that, you don't know everything, and to make whatever decision you make based on knowledge and not based on ignorance. Because a decision based on ignorance is not a decision. It simply is a failure to be aware of the different alternatives. Okay? So that's kind of the little commercial for what a program like this and other programs are really involved with. Okay? And as I indicated, it will be here for 2 weeks. Hopefully some of you will stay longer. Obviously, this is only a beginning, and the goal also is that you will continue your investigation later. You know, there's a columnist for the New York Times who wrote a very excellent book. I don't even know if he's Jewish, but he has a strong ethical consciousness. David Brooks, I don't know if you've come across this. He's a columnist, and he's gotten into ethics, and he talked about types of values this is a person's life. They are called resume values, and they are called eulogy values. Resume values are those qualities that we have that help us advance in the world. You know, we're smart, we're ambitious, we're quick thinking, we're original. The type of stuff you want to put on your resume to show that, you're deserving of a promotion or a certain job. But he says, those are the resume values. But the eulogy values is, what would we like people to say about us at our funeral? And, we don't want necessarily people to say, oh, he was so great. He was such a cutthroat litigator. He never let anybody get by. It was wonderful. On the day of his mother's death, he managed to sell a shopping center, right after the funeral. In a eulogy, what we would like people to say about us, whether they'll say it or not, and maybe they'll say it even if it's not true, because eulogies re-exaggerate sometimes. Person was kind, they were compassionate, they were loving, they were giving. They sacrificed some of their money in order to be with their family more. Now, that's how we would want to be remembered. This is David Brooks' point. The only problem is that in most of our life, we're pursuing resume values, when in fact, the real thing we really, 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 really want are the eulogy values. It's really a tremendous, sad tragedy in some ways that so much of our education, so much of our psychic energy, so much of our mental effort is devoted to kind of building up our resumes in one way or the other. And very little time is spent in terms of asking ourselves, how do I create a good marriage? How do I be a good parent? So later for you guys down the road, how do I, become a good person, a good and ethical and moral person? We kind of think, that'll happen automatically. I'll focus on my career, I'll focus on all these things automatically, I'll become a good person. I don't know if other people are or not, but at the inside that you get out, the inside that you find over and over and over again. They are true. They are absolutely true. And this is an opportunity as well, not only to acquire specific information, but to ask yourselves, what is life about? For many, many years, my wife and I have only been living in Israel 5 years. Feels like 50 now. That's about 5 years. And many, many years I was a law professor myself. I was a rabbi also, but I was a law professor at the University of Maryland, so I'm very familiar with law students, but the same thing is true for other types of graduate students as well. And we live in a very, very ambitious society. People want to get ahead in different ways, particularly when the economy is weak, it's kind of an ambition to push ahead. And this is so extreme that there are certain kindergartens or nurseries in Manhattan that have, I don't even know what this means, but supposedly they have a 5-year waiting list. Now, I'm not sure. Generally, you go to nursery when you're 4, so I'm not sure what a 5-year. So as soon as wife shows a little bit of pregnancy, know, register that kid in that nursery or the like. And why is that so good? Because there is a sense sometimes, hey, the people you meet in a fancy nursery, you know, they may be the lifelong friends that'll get you, you know, career connections and the like. And be it as it may, you know, there are private elementary schools, and then there are high schools, and then, of course, in college, we're working for great grades to get into graduate school, and then graduate school, you want to excel for law and medicine. And then, eventually, what happens is, you know, you keep on moving up and up and up and up and up, but then you hit the ceiling. There's going to come a point in your life when you're going to know that you're not going to be president of the United States, or in the case of a lawyer, you're not going to be on the Supreme Court of the United States. You're not going to win an Olympic gold medal. And we call this midlife crisis, basically. In other words, you've gone as far as you're going to go in this life. And the rest of life is just going to be more of the same. Meaning, you're still in the area where, you know, you have things to look forward to in terms of, you know, advancing in the world. But there's going to come a point in time in which, you know, I've plateaued. I've gone as far as I'm going to go. And then you get hit with burnout. You get hit with a life crisis. You know, Alexander the Great, the legend has it, you know, he died at, I think, 32. And legend has it, although he probably died of some type of plague, but legend has it he died of heartbreak, because after conquering the entire known world, he sobbed and said, "I have no worlds left to conquer." I mean, this is going to be a problem, you know, people like Bill Clinton, you know, they become president, Obama will face this problem. But Bill Clinton, I think the money that he gets may maybe comfort some of the pain of course, you know, who knows. But the point basically is that when your life is predicated on careerism and workaholism, inevitably there's going to come a point in which you're going to ask yourself, is this enough? What's the purpose? What's the goal? All of my life I've been running towards something. But once I reach it, what is going to be? And one of the things that Judaism gives a person is that Judaism gives a person a sense that there's a transcendental meaning in life. There is a purpose. There is a nation that you're connected to. There's a destiny that you have. That the virtue of life, the kindness, the love, the commandments, give you a purpose and give you a direction. And of course the study of Torah provides infinite spiritual joy, but also intellectual joy, right? In terms of keeping the mind active and the like, as you'll see when you study the Talmud and the like. So a person when they're young, I was young once, I remember that vaguely, when a person is young, you know, maybe you don't think about this so much because you still have so many steps of advancing, finishing your school, getting a career, getting ahead, etc. But I will tell you, maybe it's not the most optimistic of thoughts, but there will come a time that if you don't pursue a spiritual life, if you don't pursue an internal life, if you don't pursue what David Brooks calls the eulogy values, and you only focus on the resume values, there is going to come a time in which you're going to hit a blank wall, and you're going to say, gee, is this all there is to life? And I know there's a lot of research studies. Again, I'm most familiar with law students, about law student burnout or lawyer burnout. Could be in the late 30s, could be in the 40s, could be in the 50s, whatever it might be. But it does come. And the consequences could be very devastating. There's alcoholism, there's drug addiction, there's adultery, you know, whatever it might be, whatever you call a midlife crisis. But a midlife crisis is a real phenomenon, and in some ways it's a justified phenomenon, because a person just wonders, like, what is the purpose of things? It does hit you. It's interesting that these types of questions specifically exist in more affluent societies. You know, if you live in Africa and you got to spend the whole day looking for a piece of bread, you don't necessarily have time to contemplate the existential quandaries of life. But Vedanta specifically, in societies that are more affluent, where there's a certain amount of economic security, that is where the search for meaning becomes a very, very powerful and legitimate striving. And as a religious Jew, I would say it's because God gave us a soul, and our soul wants to connect to God. It is seeking meaning and purpose. And when we don't seek that meaning and purpose, there is tremendous pain and suffering which can then manifest itself in dysfunctional ways. So these are some things to think about. Again, as I say, for some of you this will resonate, for us others, you know, you don't yet see that or feel that, but all I can do is warn you that it surely will come, if not now, later, so you might as well try to address the issue now. Okay, so again, we're very, very happy that you are, and we hope that you'll take advantage of all of the, I don't want to say everything Israel offers, but everything kosher that Israel offers, everything that's spiritually uplifting and the like. I wanted to go back a little bit, and pardon me for going back two holidays ago, but as everybody knows, most Jews are really not that observant of the traditions anymore. It's very, very unfortunate. But there are some traditions that almost every Jew does keep even today. And the three most common traditions, well, four most common traditions that almost everybody keeps, although even those are being undermined. Number one is circumcision. If you're a boy, although there is an anti-circumcision movement that Jews are involved in, but still, whether it's conservative, reform, orthodox, even secular, you know, circumcision is still one of the things that we do to our kids, so to speak. The other is Yom Kippur. Again, maybe not everybody fasts for 24 hours, but there is kind of a symbolic idea of Yom Kippur. The third is the lighting of Hanukkah candles, although that might be because it's competition with December 25th. And the fourth is the Passover Seder, okay, which we just had a month ago. I want to talk a little bit about the Passover Seder, because perhaps that might be the freshest holiday that is in your mind. The event that the Passover Seder celebrates is not the Last Supper of Jesus, although that was indeed a Seder. By the way, I hope you notice, if you look at Da Vinci's celebrated painting of the Last Supper, you will see the four goblets, four little cups on the table, because Da Vinci knew the halacha that at a Passover Seder you drink four cups of wine, so you put the four cups, although I have to say it's smaller than the amount of wine the rabbis recommend to drink. So Da Vinci apparently paskened that you could use less of a quantity. What's the cognition here for those of you that are the inside joke? But the event that the Passover Seder celebrates is Yetziat Mitzrayim. Yetziat Mitzrayim means the exodus of Egypt. Now, there's one passage in the Haggadah, which is the book that we read at the Seder, that I think is very, very important, very instructive. And maybe you remember this from your Seder. Each person must regard themselves as if they themselves were taken out of Egypt. That you're not just remembering the exodus of Egypt, but you have to feel that you're actually experiencing the exodus of Egypt. And you have to underline a topic sentence in the Haggadah. I don't know if you ever did this grammar school pattern. What is the topic sentence of the paragraph? What is the main theme of the paragraph? One might say that this is such an important idea that the main theme of the Haggadah is that the Exodus is not simply commemoration of a historical event, but it's an actual experience that we have. Now, the question then becomes, what on earth does that mean? What do you mean, each person must regard themselves as if they themselves were taken out of Egypt? I was not in Egypt. I was not a slave in Egypt. I was not taken out of Egypt. What do we mean, I must regard myself as if I was taken out of Egypt? What does that even mean? Well, some interpret it that it's kind of a Lee Strasberg, Marlon Brando method acting technique. That in order to appreciate, I don't mean that trivially, in order to appreciate God's kindness, you have to use your power of imagination to imagine what it was like to be a slave. And now we have the Moses movie that can give you a little bit of an indicator there. To be beaten and to be tortured. And by imagining it, by putting right, what does the method actor do? You imagine that you're going through this very experience. Which means it is a form of sophisticated imagery and visualization in order that you should appreciate God's kindness. Okay, that is legitimate, and that's not trivial. I mean, God did a wonderful thing to the Jewish people, and we don't always understand it, so we have to kind of imagine what it was. In Kabbalistic Hasidic sources that I think is very worthy of God. And that is, let's analyze the words in a literal sense. Every person must regard themselves as if they themselves were taken out of Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim, I translate it as Egypt, because that is the biblical term for the land of Egypt. Of course, keep in mind, modern Egyptians are an Arabic people. They are not the ancient Egyptians. The ancient Egyptians of the pharaohs, or the pharaohs, are extinct. But nevertheless, that's the trend. But in Hasidic literature, we find that Mitzrayim has a double meaning. Mitzrayim is the name of a nation or a country, i.e. Egypt. But Mitzrayim also means constriction, limitations, boundaries, blockages. King David in the Psalms says, Min ha-meitzar, meitzar is the same word as Mitzrayim, singular. Min ha-meitzar kalesi ka. From the narrow boundaries that block me from my desperation, I call out to God. So based on this, it's a bit of a homiletical twist. When it says each person must regard himself as if they were taken out of the triumph, that means every person has to identify an inner slavery that is within themselves, a blockage, a distortion, a narrow confining place. It could be my arrogance. It could be my selfishness. It could be my lack of self-esteem, my sense of hopelessness and despair. It could be my egotism. In other words, there's an inner enslavement that every human being has that is preventing their flourishing and their realization of the beauty that is within. Seen in this way, Yetziat Mitzrayim, the Exodus, is both historical fact, and we do not deny the historicity of the Exodus. How we know that, that I've discussed in other lectures. I don't mean to say everything's a metaphor. We do believe in the historical reality of these events. But historical reality does not displace or replace metaphorical understanding. The two ideas exist side by side. In many ways, historical experience itself is symbolic of deeper truth. And the deeper truths, so it's not an either or, I'm glossing over this, this is a fairly important point. People will often debate, is the Exodus a metaphor or is it a fact? My answer is yes. Meaning, it is a fact and it is also a metaphor. It is a reality and it's also a symbol of a deeper spiritual reality. The reality is God did take 3 million Israelites out of Egypt. But it is also a symbol for the capacity of the human being with God's assistance to liberate themselves from their inner slavery to become free. And the inner Mitzrayim is much more difficult to vanquish than the outer Mitzrayim. In the ancient days, when there used to be cigarette commercials on TV, way before you guys were born, so Salem, I don't know if there even is a Salem brand of cigarette anymore, but I haven't looked. But there used to be a jingle on TV. You can take Salem out of the country, but you can't take the country out of Salem. I don't even know if you remember, I've even heard this, but this was a very popular jingle in the early 1960s. So similarly, we could say, you can take the Jew out of Mitzrayim, but it's much harder to take the Mitzrayim out of the Jew. All of us, and I obviously include myself, we have within us pockets that block us, that constrain us, that constrict us. Anger, selfishness, egotism, greed, laziness, whatever it would be. Arrogance, or lack of self-esteem, depression. You know, either one of those things. And that enslaves us. That stops us from moving forward. We have resentments. We have grudges. Sometimes it's because of things that happened in our childhood. And again, or in our adulthood, whatever it is, there could be actual serious abuse. But you see it in the shrine, it's a great lesson. That God gives us the capacity to be liberated from that which enslaves us. That's a wonderful, powerful lesson. That a human being is more than being a victim of them. It's very demeaning to say, oh, I am the way I am because of all of this stuff that happened. Doesn't have to be that. We can transcend. We can go beyond. We can break through. And that is the lesson of Yetzias Mitzrayim. And that is the meaning of the end. Each person must regard themselves as if they were enslaved in Mitzrayim, and God liberated. If I could quote a very eminent authority, do you know the entertainer Mr. T? Is he still around? Yet I haven't been following his career of late. But Mr. T, I once came across a remark of Mr. T that I thought was profound, perhaps unintentionally profound, but it was profound. And Mr. T was asked why he always wears gold chains around his neck. So Mr. T responded that he wears gold chains because he wants to emulate his ancestors who came to the United States from Africa, and they came as slaves. And he says they also wore chains. The difference is their chains were iron and around their legs, and my chains are gold and they're around my neck. Do you see the wisdom of Mr. T's remark? Mr. T is teaching us that the gold chain around the neck can be very as much enslaving as the iron chain around the leg. The iron chain means I'm a slave. But I could be a slave to greed, to money, to power. And that's also a form of slavery. Indeed, his point that he's doing the same thing as his ancestors, that there's a self-imposed slavery, this rat race that we are committed to. This is why, and we'll talk more about this later in the week, and after that, this is the idea of Shabbat. Shabbat is the ultimate freedom in which you disengage from the materialistic, accumulative nature of society in order to focus on the virtues of the soul, in order to focus on what, again, Mr. Brooks calls the eulogy values of life instead of the resume. That's why Shabbat is such a wonderful, unique contribution. Again, I don't want to get ahead of myself on Shabbat that much, but you've heard of Norman Mailer? You know, famous mid-20th century novelist. So he's kind of a crazy guy. Many affairs, drug addict, he did all sorts of, he did everything in his life. But one of the things that he did, although he had no chance of getting any votes, is in the 1960s, he decided to run for mayor of New York. Again, there's no, just the publicity stuff, there was no way that he would get any, vote. Well, that's somewhere, but there was no way he could win. In fact, he was asked what would be the first decision he would make if he were to be elected. So he would say, demand a recount. But one of his proposals in the 1960s was that there ought to be something called a Super Saturday, that traffic would be banned from Manhattan, that stores would be closed, etc., that people should be able to experience relating to their families without their address and their having the like. It's very interesting that essentially he would basically say, let's bring Shabbat to Manhattan, to the public square. So he understood this idea of getting away from it. But this is a powerful idea of Yetzias Mitzrayim, to recognize our inner slavery. And in that sense, therefore, when you read the Haggadah of Passover, you're really doing a double message. You're reading a historical story, and then you're trying to apply it to yourself. Now, it's very interesting, and this fewer people do. We just had a holiday a few days ago. Everyone knows what the holiday we had a few days ago was. On Sunday, we had a holiday. We called Shavuot. Now, Shavuot, or Shavuos, again, different pronunciation of Hebrew, is kind of an unknown holiday, a little bit, unfortunately. I remember, after my first year of law school, so I come from Hartford, Connecticut, and in those days, although not necessarily anymore, Hartford was known as the insurance capital of the world. We were very excited about all the big insurance companies that were located in Hartford. So I had a job as a legal intern in the Aetna Life and Casualty Company, big insurance company. And Shavuot would be was a few weeks after I started my work. So I told my supervisor, who was a nice Roman Catholic attorney, that I'm not going to be able to do the 2 weeks. I will have to take off whatever the day's work, Monday and Tuesday, because it's a Jewish holiday, Shavuot, and I'm not allowed to go to work. Okay, that was fine. Around a half an hour later, he comes in and he says, you know, can you just give me verification that there's a holiday here? Because I spoke to 10 Jewish attorneys in the office, and they never heard of it. They didn't know what this was. They know Passover, you make a Seder. They know Rosh Hashanah, even if they don't know Kippur, but they know Rosh Hashanah, they know Yom Kippur. They even know Sukkot, because they see the booths, you know, the huts out there. But Shavuot? Gee, they didn't hear about that one. Now, so Shavuot is indeed under the radar. But Shavuot is an extremely important holiday. What happened on Shavuot is, that is when God gave us the Ten Commandments, and that is when God the Torah on Shavuot. Now, the Torah says, between Passover, Pesach, and Shavuot, we undergo a daily countdown. Actually, we count up the days. That's called the Omer. The Omer basically says, we count each of the days between Passover and Shavuot. So we'll say, we start on the second day of Passover, we'll say, today is the first day of the Omer going toward Shavuot. Second day of the Omer. So 49 days. We count. We count. This is called the counting of the Omer. It only takes 30 seconds every day, but we have to do it. We have to count. We have to connect. What is the purpose of counting the Omer? The purpose of counting the Omer is to create a linkage, a connection between the holiday of freedom and the holiday of commitment and discipline to God. They're not two different holidays, but freedom has a purpose only when it is linked to a higher calling. People make a big mistake when they say the purpose of life is to be free. To be free is not a purpose, it is a means, it is not an end. Because the question becomes, okay, I'm free. Free to do what? Free to be what? Freedom alone is very important, and of course we have to be very grateful for living in any society that gives us freedom, especially the Jewish people, Baruch Hashem, in Israel, which is our nation, but in the United States as well, which has given freedom to not only Jews, but to so many populations. That is why a religious Jew is a patriot. A religious Jew is actually grateful to the United States for all the opportunities. But at the end of the day, freedom is the beginning of a question. It is not the end. That is, okay, I'm free. What do I do with the rest of my life? That's why Eric Fromm, a disciple of Freud, once said that it's not enough to have freedom from something. You have to have freedom towards something. Freedom has to be towards something, not just an absence of restriction. And that is why the Jewish calendar is so attuned to the idea that Passover and Shavuot are not two separate holidays, but we thematically link them by counting the Omer, that freedom without responsibility is worthless. And symbolically, this is brought out in a lot of good ways. For example, when there's a temple, and you're going to visit the Western Wall, and maybe you've done so already, and that is the wall of the outer courtyard of the temple, but the Holy Temple was located, unfortunately, where now there are mosques and the like. But when there was a temple, we would bring different sacrifices. And on Passover, the sacrifice that was brought was a barley sacrifice, because that's the barley harvest occurred. Barley is the first grain that ripens in Israel. On Passover, Shavuot, we brought a wheat sacrifice. Now, that does correspond with the barley cycle and the wheat cycle. But our sages gave us a deeper symbolic meaning. They pointed out Barley in those days was commonly fed to animals. Wheat was human bread. Passover without Torah is animal liberation. You're still a wild animal. Human dignity occurs only when there's submission and discipline. Freedom without responsibility is not only worthless, but it's dangerous, counterproductive, disruptive, and the like. The truth is, I'll give you a beautiful quote, again from a non-Jewish source, a little more erudite than Mr. T. This is the Indian poet Tagore. Tagore won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1920, so he's long dead, but he's a wonderful, wonderful, beautiful poet. And he was not writing about Judaism. I don't know if he knew any Jewish people. But he said the following observation. He said, the human soul is like a violin string. A violin string, any stringed instrument, has a beautiful capacity for music. Produce a tune, produce things that can stir your emotions and uplift you. But imagine a string that's totally free. I have a loose string on the table. This is a string. It's free, unencumbered, not tied down. What music can you get from a loose string? Nothing at all. Paradoxically, the music and the beauty that is within can be expressed only when the string is stretched taut and tied down on a framework. Paradox. We think submission is limited. We think submission destroys our ability to express ourselves. We think that tying ourselves down to God somehow deprives us of becoming the person we're capable of becoming. But Tagore's metaphor is so telling. It's precisely in that submission that there can be the self-realization of the beauty within. And that is exactly the message of our sages in linking Passover to Shulot. Don't you see? And again, let me just give you an analogy outside of religion. Forget about religion for a moment. Because these are universal truths that cross all sorts of boundaries. You know, if you see a jazz musician, and the jazz musician can do these riffs, these improvisations, really just so amazing. And you know, you're learning an instrument. And you know, you're learning a piano, right? So the teacher says, practice these scales for the next 2 hours. And you're doing scales. This is so boring. I want to improvise. I want to just play. Blah, blah, blah. No, he does, no, this musician, all he does is do riffs. I want to do riffs. Well, you'll do your riffs, you'll sound like a three-year-old. Meaning, we don't always realize that spontaneity and creativity still have to be predicated on the discipline of mastering a craft. Meaning, the guy that can do the improvisation also spends hours playing scales at some point in his life. The Picassos of the world, or the abstract artists who just kind of still looks like they just spill paint and whatever, but it, to the extent there is an artistic thing, I'm not sure I can identify it, but it still came from the mastery of technique. Meaning to say, in all areas of life, it is the discipline and the submission that eventually liberates you, empowers you, enables you to flourish as an individual, even though it seems that you're kind of enslaving yourself to a certain discipline. And that's how it works with Torah as well. You know, to some degree, you can look at religious Jews and say, superficially, oh, they're monochromatic, literally, one color. They all look the same, they act the same, they do the same. Well, you know, sociologically, there may be different issues that need to be addressed, but in terms of what the religious tradition teaches, it actually teaches, by submitting yourself to God's will through the mitzvah, the commandment, you actually become empowered and enabled to develop your own individuality, your own creativity, your own access to God. Judaism is not about squelching who you are. It is a tool for self-realization of the divinity of the universe. That does require a certain amount of sacrifice, a certain amount of willingness, as it were, to submit yourself to the will of God. Okay, and that is why it's very important that although the Passover Seder might be a celebration of freedom, it is coupled almost immediately with an interest to the next holiday of Shavuot, which is the holiday of the Matan Torah Torah. This might be why we have a curiosity. Anyone know what these two are? Later in the summer, the 9th of Av was the day that the two temples were destroyed and the Jews were exiled from the land. In later years, there were many other tragedies that occurred on the 9th of Av. For example, the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492, which was a great tragedy, was on Tisha B'Av in the Hebrew calendar. World War I, which began with the assassination of Franz Ferdinand of Austria-Hungary, that occurred on Tisha B'Av. But you might say, well, big deal. One guy gets killed. What about the Holocaust? But the answer is that essentially, World War II was really a continuation of World War I. Basically, the unresolved tension of the Treaty of Versailles led to the Nazi power. So in a sense, we could say the assassination of Franz Ferdinand that triggered World War I was essentially the beginning of the Holocaust in a historical way that also occurred on Tisha B'Av. So it's interesting that in the Jewish calendar we have certain quirks. And one of the quirks of the Jewish calendar is that the day of the week of the first Passover Seder will be the same day of the week as the 9th of Av later in the summer. So if, for example, the Passover Seder was Tuesday night, of course, that's Wednesday, because the day begins at night. So if the first day of Passover is Wednesday, actually it can't be that. If the first day of Passover is Thursday, then the 9th of Av is going to be Thursday. The calendar works out that way, that there's a correlation in day of the week between Passover and Tisha B'Av. Why would that be so? It's kind of very odd. So I'll suggest to you a little speculation for which I do not have any source. My speculation is, the first day of Passover is the only day that's not yet linked to the holiday of Shavuot, because we don't count the Omer until the second day of Passover. So the first day represents freedom that is not yet linked to responsibility. It's freedom without the responsibility. Lesson? Freedom without the responsibility leads to Tisha B'Av, destruction. It's only the second day we start linking it to Shavuot, because that's what he said about the Yom. So again, there's all sorts of nooks and crannies here, which bring out the point in many, many different ways. Now, final point about the Passover Seder, because again, I'm really not, you might think I'm crazy. Why am I talking about the Passover Seder? But because it is the paradigm for inner spiritual liberation, and it encompasses the paradigm that you become liberated to the extent you become submissive to God. That submission to God is the method by which we can achieve liberation. That is, there are three central symbols of Passover, and this is also in the Haggadah. Rabbi Gamliel used to say, anyone that does not explain three basic symbols has not fulfilled his obligation. And if you remember that passage, that is the paschal lamb, the sacrifice that they brought when they were in the temple, because God skipped over the houses. Pesach literally means skipping over the houses. In the plague of the firstborn, God passed over the houses of the Israelites, and he smote the Egyptians, because we have the blood of the paschal lamb on our doorposts. This is in Exodus 12. By the way, not that I'm going to give you a class in Christianity, but as you know, Jesus made much of the paschal analogy. He considered himself to be the paschal lamb, so to speak, and as a result, just as the lamb of the blood of the lamb was an atonement for the Jewish people, so he took the position that their theology developed in their particular way. We do not accept that theology at all, but the Korban Pesach was a reality. So there is the Paschal Lamb, the second is the matzah, and the third is the bitter herbs. And these are the three symbols of the Pesach. We have other things we do too, but these are the three most important symbols: the Paschal Lamb, the matzah, the maror. So here, what I would like to suggest to you is a thought. Again, it's not my thought. The Hasidic books say it, that these are also three steps in achieving our own personal liberation. Let's first talk about maror. I'm going to go in reverse order. Eat bitter herbs. Some people actually have horseradish, which is pretty tough. Others wimp out, they have open lettuce, it's a little bitter, but they don't know, no big deal. But why don't we eat bitter herbs? Because it's a symbolic way of remembering the bitterness of slavery. In your good times, remember the bad times. That keeps you humble. That's you eat the bitter herbs. So I would suggest the following. Again, it's not my method, but the suggestion is made that the first step towards being spiritually liberated is to be honest enough to recognize you're a slave to something. That if you're in a state of denial that you're not even a slave, then you have no way of becoming free. You can't become free till you taste the bitterness of your slavery. Which means maror is a symbol to honestly acknowledge to yourself, not to other people, what it is in my life that's dysfunctional. What it is in my life that I need to correct. The cognitive courage and honesty of facing our inner demons and saying, you know, I got to work on this. I got to change this. I got to try to be better at this. Instead of just ignoring it and sweeping it under the spiritual rug. Now, I remember when I began teaching at the University of Maryland Law School, which was in Baltimore. So I lived in Silver Spring, Maryland, which is near Washington. So I had to drive north. Right? So you're going 95 north. Right? You know that part of the country. So if you're driving 95 north and you're not watching, you could very easily turn off to 95 south. So I was, you know, my mind was somewhere else. All of a sudden, as I'm driving on 95, I see the Washington Monument, the Jefferson Memorial, which, for those of you who don't know that part of the country, you're not supposed to see on the way to Baltimore. When you're going from the Washington area to Baltimore, you're not seeing that, because those are closer to Virginia. So I said to myself with a sinking feeling, oh no, 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 no. Am I going south? And I can't even explain it, but emotionally, I didn't want to admit to myself I was on the wrong road. I said, well, you know, maybe from Baltimore you can see it, so maybe I never noticed it before, but you know, maybe I'm on the right road, or maybe if I just keep on going, you know, it will change. Now, it is true, it will change, because 95 ends in Florida, in Key West. You can get it. All you got to do is loop around, you know? But I would have been late for class, you know, that day, you know? So, it makes no sense, I understand it makes no sense, but I didn't want to admit I was on the wrong road. Because I didn't want to admit it, I just kept on going for a while until I finally broke down because I had no choice. The first step towards getting on the right road is to be honest with you, to admit to yourself I'm on the wrong road. That's a major, major step. That's a hard step. And that is maror. Maror is tasting your slavery, admitting it. I get angry too much. Too selfish. Admitting it. That takes courage. That takes guts. I'm not talking about public confessions. We don't do that. I'm talking about to yourself. But being aware of our flaws is not enough. We then have matzah. Everyone knows the story of matzah. Matzah is unleavened bread. And if you remember, the Israelites wanted to bake bread. And in the morning, the Egyptians said, get out of here! Get out of here! Get out of here! And we didn't even have time to let our dough rise. We had to bake it right away or bake it in the sun. And that's why it was unleavened, because there was no time to let it rise. We had to bake it right away. Okay, the difference between leavened bread and unleavened bread is simply how soon after kneading the dough do you bake it. Matzah is baked immediately, and regular bread rises for a while. That's called chametz versus matzah. And as you know, Passover is the dough chametz bread. And now they have all these artificial foods, so they can make fake Pesach bread again. That's another issue. Now, matzah therefore represents taking action, because chametz is inertia. If I put water on the flour and do nothing, it'll rise automatically. Matzah is, I gotta take. Matzah requires initiating. Chametz is only inertia. So, the message is this, the following. No, there's a difference between psychotherapy and behavioral therapy. Psychotherapy focuses on looking at your past, understanding yourself, understanding your trauma and the source of your pain. We'll go back to childhood trauma, birth trauma, pregnancy trauma, preconception trauma. And a person can be in psychotherapy for 50 years. And they know everything about themselves. And they have a whole log of every bowel movement they had, from the time that they were born and the like. But sometimes you get so involved in analyzing yourself that you don't take practical, constructive action. Behavioral therapy. So if moral is the cognitive awareness of my flaws, masa is seize the moment. Carpe diem. Don't be a product of inertia. It's not enough to understand yourself. You must make the commitment to positive, constructive action. It can be small, but the nature of virtuous action is it builds upon itself. You conquer the little goals, then you get strength and courage to keep on persevering. So, maror is the courage of confronting my flaws. Matzah is taking action to be a better person. And then finally comes the Pesach. And the Korban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb, is a very interesting sacrifice. Because even if you have a ravenous appetite, and it's a small lamb, and you can finish the whole thing yourself, you cannot bring the Paschal Lamb by yourself. You must join with family, either your family or friends, which means Pesach highlights the importance of community. That in our process of spiritual journey, we need people. Could be our immediate family, friends, our community, our synagogues, our pillow houses, whatever it is. We need people that share these goals. Because each person gives strength to the other person. There are times that I'm weak, that I falter, I don't have motivation. And a good friend will help me out of this. And there are times I'm weak and you're strong. And there are times that I'm strong and you're weak. And you know, we think of friendship sometimes in superficial terms. Oh, friends are people you go to baseball, you go to ball games with. Or friends are people you have a beer with. And that's all true, and I'm not diminishing that. Friends are people you hang around with. True. But the deepest level of friendship, that could be in a marriage, of course. That should be in a marriage, but it could be outside of a marriage as well. The deepest level of friendship are not simply people you kill time with. So that has a role too. But people that help each other become the best person they can become. The people that encourage you to be better, to grow, to try to accomplish, and you also are there for them. And that is the message of Pesach. So the three symbols are moror, confront my failures. Matzah, do something about it. Pesach, find a community of people who share those commitments that you can work together. Well, Baruch Hashem, you have your ready-made community right here. So go ahead and do it. Identify, and each person makes their own. It's not for me that, God forbid, tell anybody
what their problems are.
I have more than enough of mine. But look into your life. What do I need to improve on? How do I become a better person? Matzah, think about practical strategies to address it. And Pesach, get the support of the community So you're all wonderful. So meeting you will. Yeah.
If anyone has any questions up there, if they're wondering for us,
I'll be here. I'm not going anywhere. So over the course of the next few weeks, I'll be happy to talk to anyone who would like to talk.
I asked someone to record this.
Congratulations.
How are you?
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Wonderful. What law school are you from?
Syracuse.
Very nice. Very nice. Yeah. So a lot of luck. You know the old saying, first year of law school, they scare you to death. The second year, they work you to death. And the third year, they bore you to death.
Yeah.
So hopefully you won't be too scared.
No.
Or too bored.
I'm ready for it. I have some friends who have given me some guidelines and they've gone through it. So.
That's wonderful. Of course, the winters are tough.
Yes, very tough. Very different than Texas.
That's right, the weather is the opposite.
Yes.
Yeah. A lot of luck. Where are you from? Are you from Texas?
Yes, I'm from Texas. But my family.